Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. The oyster is one of Earth's oldest animals, and fossil records show humans have enjoyed or relied on them for hundreds of thousands of years. The popularity of wild oysters, coupled with the effects of water pollution, drove them to near extinction. The Clean Water Act of 1972 marked a turning point for water quality, and we are witnessing a renaissance in oyster culture. Dan Martino is the author of The Oyster Book, a chronicle of the world's most fascinating shellfish, past, present, and future. Dan, welcome to the program.
Hey, Mindy, thanks for having me.
All right, so you are also an oyster farmer on the vineyard, and you believe pretty strongly that aquaculture is the future of humanity, so much so you quit your job in TV production to pursue this career in shellfish farming. You knew nothing about it.
Yes, I knew. I didn't even know how to drive a boat.
So what prompted that?
So my prior career, I was a TV producer doing shows for HGTV and Discovery Channel and Nat Geo and a bunch of fun stuff. And ended up going to New York to a place called Governor's Island because we had heard about a project called the Billion Oyster Project that was going to be starting up. And this was, you know, 2010 or 2009, somewhere back in there. And Governor's Island was a private place at that point. It was a military base that hadn't been turned over to the public yet. So we had to get credentials and security passes and jump on the ferry. And we go to the Billion Oyster Project headquarters. And it was literally like overturned bunk beds and the holes in the ceiling. And we meet this guy, Pete Malinowski, and he's young and cool and super enthusiastic about what's going to happen. And we kind of realized that we were there way too early. He ends up, we ask him, well, do you have any oysters? And not really. And he shows us these little baby oysters that were like the size of your pinky nail. And from a TV show perspective, that's not a lot of good content to kind of, it's not interesting. And I think he picked up on that. And so he told us to go to his parents' farm on Fisher's Island in New York to go see where the oysters were actually coming from and how it all kind of worked, how oyster farming worked, because I didn't know anything. So I lugged my camera to Fisher's Island, and I got to, again, go on another ferry and meet with the Malinowski family there. And they gave me an overview of how oyster farming works. And so it was really this kind of saturation into this industry that I knew nothing about, and their enthusiasm and sustainability and just the thought process of why they were farming oysters really rubbed off on me. And so I basically wanted to become an oyster farmer from that day since, and haven't stopped.
So, yeah. So you and your brother, founded Cottage City Oysters Farm in Oak Bluffs, both of you zero experience, but you did a lot of research, right? And we see much of that in the book. So you really kind of dove into this.
Yeah. And I've approached, that's kind of my life's philosophy, right? Like, assuming I don't know anything at all and trying to learn as much about it as possible. Why, you know, usually it's baptism by fire where I'm kind of just in there making a lot of mistakes and learning the hard way. But yeah, I find that reading as much as possible can kind of give you a jump on things.
Yeah. Lots of interesting things in the book that I learned. Of course, who doesn't love to eat oysters? That part I did know. But I didn't realize how many different species of oysters there are.
Definitely. There's about a dozen oysters that we farm on planet Earth for human consumption. But there's way more that we use for pearl farming or that are just, you know, natural in the environment.
Yeah. And here's a surprise. You write, the immensity of the historical oyster population cannot be overestimated. The amount of oyster biomass that has been created on Earth is most likely the largest of any species in history. Many of the modern-day hills and mountains are the remains of these ancient oyster reefs, which now exist far above sea level due to modern uplifting of the continents. Who knew?
Yeah, and what's cool is, I'm from Texas originally, and You know, I'll go back to visit my parents, and you go hike the mountains of, or the hills of Austin, Texas, and you look down and there's oyster shells, you know, sitting on the ground in the middle of a desert of Texas. And that used to be an oyster reef that's now been uplifted and forms the countryside of Austin. And so, yeah, they're everywhere.
Okay. So oysters have also been around for a very long time. And you say, regardless of the historical period or geographic location, shellfish, and specifically oysters, have been a staple food for every culture of humanity that's had access to the species.
Yeah, and I think that's the real, that was kind of the epiphany I had when researching this, is that this is the common food amongst even Neanderthals, right? Like, you can go way far back. But humans have just really, you know, seen their nutritional value, and it's sustained populations for hundreds of thousands of years. And it really is a common denominator food. It's the one food that's present around the world, and everybody seems to enjoy them.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned the saying, don't eat oysters in the months without an R. So why and where does that come from?
Yeah. So that goes way back. You're looking at ancient Romans and Greeks. And so there's a slight difference in how babies are made amongst oysters. European babies, or oysters, make their babies they actually incubate the young inside the female oyster. So if you end up eating one of these oysters while they're pregnant, you get a crunchy sand baby oyster mouthful, which is not very enjoyable. And oysters tend to spawn in the warmer months of the year. So your months without an R, your May, June, July, August, right? Those are that's the spawning season for oysters. So there's the thought of, you don't want to eat an oyster that's full of baby oysters because it'll be crunchy and gross. But also, you want to allow that species to procreate so you can have more of them in the future. So I think it was also a guideline of protecting the animal, knowing that, you know, you need more of them if you're trying to survive off of them.
But now we can't eat them with months that end in R.
Definitely. And refrigeration and ice and they're some of the best oysters are in months without an R.
These are pretty fascinating creatures. No brain and no central nervous system. And they have the ability to change gender.
Mm-hmm. They're ahead of their time. They're 2024. They're fluid or whatever you want to call them. But yeah, they're a very cool animal. And the older they become, they want to become females. And my wife says that's because they're smarter with age.
And the fact that the no brain and no central nervous system, I think I was reading that something that, so vegans think this is, they're okay to eat?
Yeah, we have a lot of vegetarians and vegans that will consider shellfish as and in fact, it is the most sustainable form of protein farming on the planet. I mean, when you start looking at, you know, we're using a lot of land and fresh water and fertilizers, and food is not free. It comes at an environmental cost. But when you begin looking at shellfish and seaweeds as your form of protein that you're farming, well, when we make oysters, we don't use any land. We don't use any fresh water. There's no fertilizers or feed inputs involved. And so it is the most sustainable form of protein farming on the planet. And then the fact that they're not considered sentient beings, a lot of people look to them as their protein source as opposed to spinach or beans, which take a lot of land and a lot of fresh water to produce.
And they're really good for you. This shocked me. All right. You write, just 68 calories worth of oysters, about six, give you a week's worth of immune boosting zinc and 1 to 3 days worth of vitamin D, selenium, copper, and vitamin B12. Oysters are rich in all three types of omega-3s and contain a recently discovered antioxidant called DHMBA, which is 15 times more effective in reducing oxidative stress than vitamin E. Wow.
Yeah, it really is remarkable, right? And then it's also not hard to fathom, like your ancient Roman or your old New Yorker, you know, going down to the river and eating a dozen oysters and being able to live off of that for an entire day is pretty remarkable.
Yeah, remarkable little creatures for sure. I have to say, reading this book made me want to eat more oysters.
Well, we should eat more. Yeah, and that's actually when I'm signing the book. That's like my motto right now is that a lot of people, you know, you hear farmed food and you don't know if that's good or bad. And people are very conscious right now of how food is created and whether or not it's healthy to put in our bodies or if it's made with colors and numbers for ingredients. And so one of the big messages of the book is that, right, we should be eating more farmed shellfish. This is the most sustainable form of protein farming on the planet. And that actually became a message. And this whole book actually was something I wish I would have had a decade ago when I was starting out farming.
Yeah. Well, I mean, even if you don't want to be an oyster farmer, it's fascinating just to learn so much about the history and stuff we didn't know about oysters. And I think, you know, when we think about oysters, sometimes people think about pearls, right? And not all and oysters make pearls, and it may not be as common as it once was. Natural pearls are harder to come by, right? So tell us how cultured pearls came into vogue and what the difference is.
Yep. So as you said, the natural pearls were hard to find. It would be an instance where a grain of sand or something would get inside of the oyster, and oysters that make their shells out of mother or of pearl were the most desired pearls, obviously, because it's that beautiful color that we love and material that we love. And as it's irritated by this sediment that gets into it, it calcifies it with its shell. It makes it smooth and makes it into a round pearl. And that's how the oyster kind of deals with the problem. And then what you find, so these are very expensive in antiquity, right? Like you have pearl divers that are risking their lives to get pearls for queens and kings. And then the Japanese figure out, well, hey, we can culture these things. We can actually implant a piece of porcelain into an oyster, get it to irritate the oyster, and the oyster in defense will make this pearl. And so that really spawned the pearl farming industry, which is now where all pearls come from, but they're still made by oysters, which is incredible.
Yeah. And is it any oyster that can make a pearl, or are they only certain types?
Every oyster, if the conditions are right, it will make a pearl, but that doesn't mean it has value. You really, the ones that make their shells out of mother of pearl are the ones that have the value.
Right. All right. So let's talk a little bit about some of the history here. Many countries created public commons for their seafood, but France took a little bit of a different route, right? So tell us about that.
Yeah, France made it the king's property, right? So you get into this historical state where Italy has basically, you know, the Romans have basically consumed all of the shellfish around them, and the Mediterranean, you know, is no longer has its oyster supply, and France's supply is dwindling. So you have King Louis, who's like really into oysters and wants his oysters, and well, there are no oysters, so he sends this guy crossed down the coast of what was France's territory, which included Italy at the time, to figure out how to bolster their supplies. And so Cost goes down and he finds the ancient farms of this guy Sergius Orata, who is the first oyster farmer in history, and sees the setup and basically steals the model for how this guy was farming oysters back in the day and brings it back to France and populates the coastline of France with oysters and attempt to revive them. And sure enough, they come back. And so the king says, well, those are mine, and basically claims them for the crown. And it's remained to that day. The crown owns the waters and the oysters that come off of them. And the farmers have to basically get a lease from the crown to farm their oysters on their flats.
Yeah, so and interesting too, like the numbers of oysters some of these kings ate. Holy cow!
Oh yeah, Well, and that's something we do. We do farm tours, and everybody wants to know, you know, yes, I have eaten 200 oysters in a sitting. Like, that's
wow.
I'm lucky I have a farm and I can do that. But that was the standard, right? Yeah. Like, that was like breakfast for a lot of these guys. Yeah. 200 oysters.
Breakfast, lunch, and dinner, they ate oysters, yeah. Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, so let's talk about experiments in shipping Pacific oysters from Japan to the West Coast. And we should say Pacific oysters are the ones that we mostly see farmed on the West Coast, right? And that started around 1902, but the adult oysters died. They shipped all these oysters and the adult died, but they found out that the spat did not. So tell us about that whole experiment.
Correct. Yes. Spat are baby oysters that have settled onto something and have started growing their shell. And so, you know, you get the gold rush going over to America and everybody's accustomed to eating their amazing East Coast oysters. And unfortunately, the West Coast had no natural supply of oysters, right? They had these little Olympia oysters, which are very different from the East Coast variety. And so supply and demand, you get the Japanese oyster being shipped over to the West Coast because the East Coast oyster wouldn't grow on the West Coast very well. And they found that the Japanese oyster could. So they start shipping them to the West Coast. The adults are dying, as you said, but the babies that were on those shells survived. And so they start realizing that the babies were more hardy than the adults. And they begin shipping over babies to the West Coast. And this creates the entire West Coast industry that we basically have today, which is the largest industry in the United States.
That's amazing. We are talking with Dan Martino. His book is The Oyster Book, a chronicle of the world's most fascinating shellfish, past, present, and future. And we'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Dan Martino. He's the author of The Oyster Book, a chronicle of the world's most fascinating shellfish, past, present, and future. So as we see this globalization happening with oysters and some species, we see some species we don't want, the invasive predators.
Oh, yeah. That's the biggest problem for a farmer that we deal with is figuring out how to contend with these little things.
And what are they? What are some of these invasive predators?
The biggest nuisance is the oyster drill, which is a small snail-like creature that has a chainsaw mouth. And what it does is it attaches to the outside of the oyster's shell. It drills a hole into the shell. It inserts its straw and it sucks the meat out. And these guys were native to Japan and they've just circumvented the globe at this point. So every oyster farmer on every coast of the world is dealing with these things. Mm-hmm. And they'll kill your oysters. We control them by literally when we pull out our bag of oysters out of the cage and dump them out to harvest them. We find the little snail guys in the bags and we just hand pick them out. There's no trap or anything for them. So it's a lot of labor.
And that's everywhere. Wherever there are oysters, you're going to find these guys now, right?
You got it. Yeah.
Anything else that's followed the oysters?
Yeah. The other big problem is a sponge that is also now all around the world. And it's called a boring sponge. And it's just this slimy goo that kind of covers the oyster shell. It drills holes into the shell and makes the shell its home. Doesn't kill the oyster. But if you have an oyster with shell damage from a boring sponge, it'll crumble as you're trying to shuck it open. So it basically makes the product worthless.
Yeah. Another question I'm wondering, you know, we're seeing changes in the water, you know, salinity and acidification. Is that impacting the farming of oysters? Is that something you have to contend in, or is that just pretty much the natural oysters that there's a concern about?
Yeah. So what happened was it really hurt the farming industry on the West Coast first. And this was about a decade ago where oyster hatcheries, that's where all oyster farmed oysters basically come from, is from a hatchery. And this is where they make the babies and then sell those babies to the farmers. And on the West Coast, they're bringing in water from the bay. They're spawning the babies out and all of a sudden they're dissolving kind of right before their eyes and they don't know what's happening. And it took a number of years to figure out that ocean acidification, the water had become too acidic for the babies to actually develop their shells, and they were deformed. The East Coast Atlantic is growing acidic at a slower pace than the Pacific. But the Atlantic hatcheries basically learned from the West Coast hatcheries, and they now will balance out the pH of the water prior to spawning the oysters. Mm-hmm. So we've figured out how to make it, how to, you know, manage the problem, but it is the wild oysters that will be affected the most, I think, right, because they don't have that opportunity, right, to have the water buffered.
All right, here's another surprise. You write, regardless of the location along the East Coast, the vast majority of oyster reefs in America remained intact by the time of mass European settlement. When colonists first came to America, oyster reefs were so massive that they had to be drawn on maps to keep the wooden vessels from striking them and sinking. That is so hard to picture.
Yeah, what a wonderful way to get shipwrecked and just eat your way out of it. Yeah, it's pretty remarkable. And Mark Kurtlansky has a wonderful book called The Big Oyster, and it's all about New York's history and from the oyster's perspective. And nobody tells that history better than him.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to envision, but New York City was a mecca for wild oysters. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, it was literally, you know, Pearl Street in New York was littered with oyster shells, and that was from the Native Americans. And it's the confluence of multiple rivers into a kind of a perfect ecosystem for the oyster. So when the colonists arrived, you know, the original skyscrapers were oyster middens. These are giant piles of shells where the Native Americans would just have parties and throw them in a pile of oyster shells. And so that history is remarkable. And what's more remarkable, though, is that we literally ate every oyster out of that ecosystem. Pretty amazing.
Not there anymore, unfortunately.
But the Billion Oyster Project is bringing them back, and that's again what I filmed and the entire motivation for all of it. You know?
Tell us a little bit about the Billion Dollar Oyster Project. I'm getting ahead of ourselves, but I want to, you know, for folks that don't know what that is, talk about that.
Oysters have the power to filter 50 gallons of water a day, right, per animal, which is a lot of 50-gallon milk jugs, right, of water. And what they're filtering is the phytoplankton, the algae. If you've ever played golf and you've seen the golf course pond covered in algal scum, that's what basically happens in a runaway system where you don't have shellfish that can consume this phytoplankton. It builds up too much. It starves the water of oxygen and everything kind of dies. And that's what's happened to the New York harbors. And so the Billion Oyster Project, the brilliance of it is if you put a billion oysters into the waterways, they can filter all of that phytoplankton quick enough that it rebounds the ecosystem. It cleans the water. Algae and seaweed can grow. Fish can come back. It's pretty remarkable. And so that's what that project is. And here it is a decade later now, having been started. And those oysters are now, they've put a billion in, they're propagating themselves. The king and the queen, or the prince and princess, just came from London to visit the project and showed the world how special it was. And now they're going to repeat this project in London and around the world in major cities. And it really is using this animal to, you know, bioengineer our waterways to become healthy again.
Amazing, amazing little creatures these oysters are, right? So what's the difference between West Coast and East Coast oysters?
Completely different animal. They're both oysters, but they're a different species of oyster. And that goes back to evolution when you have Pangaea and it's, you know, the one continent and one settled on one side and one settled on the other. And you know, it splits apart and you've got the one oyster in the Atlantic and the other one in the Pacific. And it really goes back that far, 540 million years ago.
Hmm. Do they taste different?
Big time. And this is what I'm exploring now is it's called miroir. So for the wine people listening, you know about terroir, right? And you have a Sauvignon grape. And if you plant that grape in France, or if you plant that same grape in California, you end up with two very distinctly tasting grapes, which make two very distinctly tasting bottles of wine. And that's what you're celebrating in the wine world is the terroir, the place that made that taste. The French call this concept for oysters, it's called miroir. And it's the exact same concept. The place makes the taste. But as you plant the same species of oyster into a different region, it takes on the flavor characteristics of that region, and that's why they all taste different. Mm. And then you get into different species of oysters, like Pacific oysters and East Coast oysters, and they have their own nuanced flavors, kind of like varieties of apples, where green ones and red ones taste different, right? And they have these intrinsic flavor values to them. And then the environment is imparting flavor into them. And so it's just this, it's amazing.
It's like a real science to all of that, right? Yeah, that we're still learning about.
That's where the industry's at right now, is figuring out. Nobody even knows how these different flavors are created or why, or can you augment them?
Yeah. All right. So let's go back in time a little bit. Talk about what it was like to be an oyster fisherman in the 1880s to 1900s. This was sort of like the peak, right? There was money to be had.
Yes, it was the prominence of wealth, right? You start having Americans have a little extra money in their pockets, and they want to eat status foods, and the oyster becomes a status food. And so you literally have, you know, what's called the pirate wars, where people are fighting with guns on the water to rake up as many oysters as possible.
Yeah. And U.S. produced as much as 160 million pounds per year, more than all the other countries combined. Again, hard to imagine that, right? I mean, so whenever you have money at stake like that, like you said, it was oyster wars, right? I mean, everybody wants a piece of the action.
Yeah, and you have these oyster pirates who are burning each other's boats down, and then you have states that actually create armies, like a navy on the water, to guard oyster sites from people from out of state, to protect the income and revenue that the states and their people can make. And and what's fascinating too is that this is happening in a time when almost all the oysters around the world, besides in the United States, have been eaten. Mm-hmm. Right? So they're America, because it was discovered so late in history, ends up having, and because of the management strategies of the Native Americans, you end up having an enormous supply of oysters that just the rest of the world didn't have access to.
Yeah, managing strategies of the Native Americans. We should have listened to them, right? We might still have those oyster reefs, right?
And we're trying to replicate that a little bit nowadays, I think.
And you're right. In the late 1800s, New Yorkers ate on average 600 oysters per year per person. Today, that number is just an average of 3 oysters per person.
Well, I'm doing my part. I'm trying to eat way more than 600. Because they're good for you.
They are. But yeah, who knew that? I mean, that they were such a staple in people's diets.
Well, and even the like Chinese takeout box that we all, you know, we get our hot rice in or whatever it might be, that folded up carton, that was originally patented as the oyster pail. Mm. And it was, you would go to the hot dog cart, but it would be an oyster cart on the street, and they would shuck your oysters for you, and they would put the meats into that little Chinese container, and then you take it home and
there you go. Yeah.
Meat your oysters.
So as one might expect, we saw over harvesting and pollution. And that really has impacted what happened to the oyster population, even here. You mentioned around the world, but of course it happened here as well.
Yeah, that was the straw that broke the camel's back, right? It was just industrialization, endless amounts of sewage being spewed into our coastal waterways with zero regulation on that process.
Yeah. So where are we today? You mentioned the Billion Oyster Project, but
even more importantly, I think, is it shows that the Clean Water Act worked. You know, this was the first legislation. Actually, it passed around the world that said, hey, you can't just dump whatever you want in the ocean. And here we are, you know, several decades later from that being passed, and it had actually worked, and it stopped corporations from dumping pollutants into the water. And the result of that is that you end up with clean waterways. And then the result of that is that you can start eating oysters and shellfish from those waterways again. And really just you know, because we had eaten every one of them basically that existed, the farming of oysters is kind of a natural byproduct of, well, we, you know, humans are still craving this food supply. And it's not there naturally. So let's start farming it. And so that's where the industry is really at now.
All right. So let's start farming it. Maybe a little easier to do in some other countries than the United States. Your application process took you 2.5 years.
Yeah. And that's lucky that we even got approved. What's crazy is you could go buy a piece of land and stick some cows on it and you don't need a permit for that. But to farm oysters, which are much more environmentally beneficial than cows, you have to go through several state, federal, and local boards. And yeah, a very long and hard process.
Yeah. And that's, I know that there's lots of marine policy around that, trying to make it. And a lot of that is probably competition with our preference for recreation in waters. Is would you say that's one of the stumbling blocks?
It's because the farming of the ocean gets lumped in with the same type of construction as a wind farm, let's say. Mm. It's literally the same permit.
Wow.
But one is dealing with, you know, a small farmer in a boat that's making food, and the other is, you know, right, multinational company.
And was it Rhode Island that had that kind of put the first aquaculture laws into?
Yeah, they were. Yeah, and but the very first lease in Rhode Island, the guy just gave up on it.
There were
so many wild ones around. He was like, "Why am I trying this hard farming? I just go pick them up." So that's what he did instead. It's a lot of hard work, you know, and I don't mean to say that all the regulations to get a farm are you know, shouldn't be there. I think a lot of them are well-intended, processes to go through, but even the government at this point realizes that it's a lot of overburden for no reason. And so they are taking steps now to make it easier to farm the ocean.
Right. We're talking with Dan Martino. His book is The Oyster Book, a chronicle of the world's most fascinating shellfish, past, present, and future. And we'll have more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Dan Martino. He's the author of The Oyster Book, a chronicle of the world's most fascinating shellfish, past, present, and future. Earlier, you mentioned getting the spat from harvesters, and there were two ways to acquire baby oyster seed, right? So you either collect it wild, you know, baby oyster, or you get the spat from a hatchery. So talk about the pros and cons of those two options.
Yeah, the traditional way of doing it was, it's like the fisherman, right? You're harvesting something out of the ocean, a wild animal, and you're planting that on your lease. And that's ultimately what led to the demise of that fishing industry, right? Is that we just over harvested them to the point where there weren't enough to make babies. You could almost back up and just say, like, well, how are babies made, right? Like, oysters. I'm talking about oysters. So you have a male oyster, you have a female oyster. They react to their environment. So when the water reaches 65 degrees for about 2 weeks, that's what triggers the oyster into baby making mode. The male oysters will shoot out hundreds of millions of sperm, and the female oysters will shoot out hundreds of millions of eggs. And this is floating in the water, and on the rare chance that these meet up while floating in the water, within 48 hours, it'll form an embryo that has an eyeball, a flipper, and a foot. This embryo's eyeball can see in black and white, so it knows which way is up and which way is down. The embryo will swim to the bottom, cement its foot to the first hard substrate that it can find. Its eyeball and its flipper will dissolve away, and then it metamorphosizes into an oyster. And at this point, we call it spat because it's mm-hmm. attached to something. This whole process is now able to happen within a hatchery in the middle of February, right? They're able to heat the water up to 65 degrees. All hundreds of millions of sperm and eggs incubate. They feed them a phytoplankton that they're growing inside of the hatchery for about a month or two until they're the size of a grain of pepper. And then that's when the oyster farmer can buy them, right? And so we're able to buy You know, there's only a handful of hatcheries on the New England coast, but these hatcheries are making hundreds of millions of baby oysters in each hatchery. And it's a great example of humans being able to do something better than nature was able to naturally do, right?
Right. And we should mention, too, they're looking at preventing disease when they do this as well. They right?
Yeah. And what's incredible, there was a disease, dermo and juvenile oyster disease. There were these natural diseases for oysters that occurred and wiped out 99% of the population. And Rutgers went around and they actually collected the survivors and have started the breeding line of those survivors. And now Rutgers gets a kickback on every oyster that's produced in the United States with this seed. So it's an endowment forever, which is brilliant. And it's amazing.
Yeah. All right. So different types of farming methods, right?
Yeah, I love it. This is what I enjoy most. My wife hates it, but we'll go on a vacation and I have to visit the local oyster farm because I need to see what they're doing and how they're doing it. And so you have floating cages now that are bobbing on the surface and the oysters are only eating the surface algae. You have bottom cages like the ones on my farm that are sitting on the bottom of the ocean underwater 24 hours a day, and they're eating the phytoplankton that's down there. You have rack and bag systems where farmers are growing things on the mud flats, just like in Duxbury or Wellfleet, where the tide goes out and they can walk out and pick up these beautiful oysters. And then you have hanging nets in the middle of the ocean that are suspended off of a long line, and they're kind of in the center of the water column, eating that phytoplankton. And so it's an XYZ axis, right? Like on land, you're stuck with just your X and Y, but in the ocean, we have a vertical growing medium that we can utilize. So it's awesome.
So why do you choose the bottom? Is there a different? I mean, what's the difference?
It's some places, regulations dictate what you can use in some places. Mm-hmm. In other places, it's like using, and this is where we're experimenting now, it's like finishing your wine in an oak barrel versus a cedar barrel or whatever barrel, right? A pine barrel. You end up with different shell shapes, different sizes of oysters. There's a lot of nuances that the gear type actually puts into the oyster.
Yeah. And here's a really important fact. You write, while the farmer can augment the appearance of the oyster, the taste of the oyster is entirely dictated by the environment that the oyster is grown in. Place makes taste. You mentioned that earlier. So really when you're doing these different types of, it's the shell. Tell us about what the perfect shell is.
The perfect shell is different for everybody, but we're all kind of striving for a teardrop shape with a deep cup and a pearl white interior. And different farm techniques and the place you're growing them will make this product look like this. The teardrop is symbolic of the ocean, right? It's a water drop. The deep cup holds the meat and the oyster liquor inside of it when it sits on a plate. And then you're trying to make them kind of uniform. Which this is an animal that when left to its own devices will grow left, right, straight, crooked, up, down. So you're kind of creating this uniform amongst this, you know, and it's all labor. To do these things, it's all labor input. And so chefs love that, you know, you get a quality product. It's power washed when it arrives to them, right? There's no oyster drills on it or seaweed. And it's just that is considered a quality oyster. But again, like you said, the taste of that is it's all the environment. Oysters do this thing called osmoconforming, where they actually take on the properties of the water that they're grown in, down to the ionic level, right? Like little positive and negative charges, they can become that.
It's so interesting. It's like, I think anybody around here who's, of course, we know about the Wellfleet oysters, but you know, you go into the restaurants and they'll have like, maybe you have Barnstable, you have Katua, you have, and if you take, you know, each of those oysters and taste it, you can taste the difference. It was funny. I was in a restaurant in Sandwich and I was saying to my friend, I was like, wow, these oysters have, you know, they have a salinity to them. They taste like Wellfleet oysters. And the owner was standing behind me, he goes, because they are Wellfleet oysters. I was like, oh, I was so proud of myself that I picked that out.
Yeah, that's really good. I'm not even there yet. I can pick my own oyster out of like a blind tasting because I've eaten it so much. Yeah. But you should sign up for like a sommelier class, girl. That's
I don't know if I can do that. There's still, of course, a lot to learn. And your farm has teamed up with the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution and Southern Connecticut State University to implement environmental monitoring studies to better understand your farm site. So what have you learned and what are you hoping to learn more about?
Yeah. Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute, HUI, is a remarkable resource. It's like the NASA of the oceans, right? It's right there. And I grew up in Texas, so I'm a big like space junkie. And so with NASA. And so to have HUI there, what they can do now is they can take a scoop of water, a cup of water. Basically what happens is all living organisms in the ocean are shedding DNA cells, right? And these cells exist in the environment and decay at certain speeds and times. And scientists know that. And so they're able to take a scoop of water, filter the DNA under a machine, and actually see which animals were present in that body of water within a designated amount of time. So now we can actually count the number of great white sharks or striped bass or lobsters that are present on our farm, which is remarkable that you can actually do that now.
Yeah.
And what we hope to learn and what we've actually proven with our farm system and through Connecticut State University is that we've looked at the eDNA and the environmental other parameters of a site next door to our farm that had none of the gear on it. And we counted the animals and we looked at the pH and how much life is there. And then we've compared that data to on our farm. And what we have found is that the oyster farm is double the amount of life than exists on the area that doesn't have the gear on it. And so we're showing basically the ecosystem services that these oyster farms are providing.
Oh, that's fascinating. And interesting that you're experimenting with influences like if oysters are aged in an oak barrel, will they exude a hint of oak? And this is like your new obsession with, you know, that Meriere, right?
Meriere, yeah.
Meriere, that's it, yeah.
It's actually the new book that I'm writing right now is all about Meriere and can you influence these tastes and how we're doing different things on our farm that we're taking some French techniques and some Japanese techniques and seeing how that changes the product.
Have you noticed? I mean, I know you're early in this process, but have you noticed a difference in what you've done
far?
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
So do you think there is that hint of oak or whatever your flavor?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, The biggest one is shaping of the product. Like we've now figured out, and every oyster farmer is going to do this now. But when the oyster is young, if you cut a little notch into it, in the middle of it, as it grows up, it makes a heart shape.
Oh.
And so we're now creating heart shaped oysters for Valentine's Day.
Okay.
All right. Why not?
Why not? Right. Yeah. People go, how did they do that? Right. So, climate change, of course, changing the food industry, and we are not really prepared for that, are we?
No, we have to feed, more people in the next 50 years than we have in all of human history, right? There's 80 something million people every year being added to the planet. We've kind of exhausted the amount of land and fertilizer we can dump on that land, and we've squeezed as much juice out of the fruit, right? So, what's happening now is it's called the Blue Revolution, and it literally is our food system moving into the oceans, to provide that food that we need.
So we are also seeing a more of a focus on local food. And that's what maybe over the past decade, not just, looking at oyster farming, but local food in general.
Yeah. And that's hard. I mean, that's actually where I'll do these book talks for the oyster book and we'll go to libraries or bookstores. And what's awesome is I get to talk to people that are obviously interested in food and have read the book. And the end of the book talks about this, where our food system's going and local food. And that's the real thing that's on everybody's mind right now is how do I sustainably eat local and not eat, the American food poison that's kind of being sold to us. And it is supporting farmers and kind of getting back, I think, to to the old ways of eating.
Yeah. What about the impacts of climate change on oyster farming itself? You know, we talked about, the acidification, but, you know, we found that you can change the pH of the water. Are you changing your techniques as we're seeing warming waters? Because obviously here in the Northeast, we want cooler waters for the oysters, right?
Right. I mean, just fast recovery for the Florida guys, because they just got decimated by the hurricane, right? And that's going to be more and more of what they're having to deal with. For us, as the water's warm, you know, the Cape and Islands is kind of forecasted to become like the Carolina-type climate, right? Fortunately, oysters grow really well in the North and South Carolina climates. So the oysters will be fine. In fact, I think some people could argue that we'll have better growing conditions in the future for oysters, which is makes even more of an argument for getting more of these farms. Eating more of these in our diets. The big one, like you said, is the pH, it's the acidity. It's one of the reasons why we started growing seaweed and kelp on our farm, is that kelp has shown to basically balance the pH of the ocean. And so there's now some thoughts about, well, do we create a circle of kelp and then grow our oysters in the center of this circle? And that way they're in a more, you know, a better balanced ecosystem than they would be without the seaweed.
Yeah. You mentioned there's about 12 different species of oysters that are farmed. Have you tasted all 12?
I have not. The best I did, I figured out that you can go to Seattle and eat, I think it's three or four of them off of Taylor Shellfish, and they're all different species, but they're all grown in the exact same environment.
Interesting. And do they taste the same?
That was the thought, right? And that's part of my new book. I don't want to give it away, okay. But no, they didn't taste the same at all, which proves that they have intrinsic values, right? They they are like apples. They each have their own distinct flavor.
Right. And of course, this whole discussion brings us back to what we said at the very beginning. Aquaculture is the future of humanity.
It is. Yeah. The future of food is blue. It's going to be seaweeds and shellfish and fish farming. You know, that's where we're heading.
All right. I'm going to have to come over to your farm and try your oysters, Dan.
Please come over anytime. We're right. You know where we are. All right. Come. We'll be out there tomorrow morning.
Dan Martino is the author of The Oyster Book, A Chronicle of the World's Most Fascinating Shellfish, Past, Present, and Future. We'll have a link with more information about the book at our website, capeandislands.org. Dan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, and support your local bookstores.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.